It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, my name's Jess Phillips and this is Yours Sincerely. I've always been a prolific letter writer, both the good and bad kind, and know the power of putting words to paper. So in this podcast, I want to give my guests a chance to celebrate three people that mean the world to them. Someone they love, someone who's no longer around, and someone who doesn't realise how significant a role they've played in their lives. And when we've heard more about each person, they'll reveal how they would sign off each letter. Nathaniel Hall is an actor, writer and theatre maker who's appeared in the TV show It's a Sin. He's the co-creative director of the Manchester Pride Candlelit Vigil and an HIV awareness activist. Today I'm excited to talk to him about the letters he would send to three people who mean the world to him. So hello Nathaniel, how are you?
I'm very well, Jess. How are you?
I noticed you've got a t-shirt on that says gender is a construct, honey. I couldn't work out what the last word was. I thought it said, like, hippie. Is it, gender is a construct hippie? I was thinking, I don't get it, but it says honey.
No, it's one of my favourite t-shirts.
It's a good t-shirt. So this is all about letter writing. And I don't. How old are you, Nathaniel?
I'm 35 years old.
Oh my God, you're literally the cutoff point of what I'm about to say. Is that I think that people, you're on the cusp of this. People under the age of 35 don't really ever write letters and never really have. Whereas people over the age of 35 have all got stories about some weird kid that they had to write letters to in the early 1990s, 1980s, because their parents made them pen pals. And some of the people who are under 35 have sometimes had to explain what the concept of a letter is. So which one of these things are you, cusp dweller?
I'm definitely on the letter writing side and the letter receiving side. I have got, I had a French exchange student.
So oh, you're perfect. Got,
like letters, like trying to write in a different language, you know, where you just like literally like going, hello, how are you? I am okay. Today I went to the swimming pool. I didn't even go to the swimming pool. It was just the only thing I could say. Yeah. So yeah, so no, I've got loads. And I went through my old memory box as preparation to look at some of the kind of old letters I got from my teenage years. Because I'm of the MSN generation as well. So lots of conversations on MSN with that, you know, that little sound and stuff. But still have got some pen and ink letters as well.
Okay, see, I think I miss the MSN thing. I'm 40, nearly 41. And I never did the messenger thing on MSN. I had babies when I was quite young, and I just think that I just was changing people's nappies at the point when that was a good thing. So your French exchange, did they write delightfully English letters back to you?
Their English was a lot better than my French.
Well, we are rubbish at languages.
I'm not going to get political about the state of the educational system, but my comprehensive high school in Stockport, languages were not the forte. But actually, I was looking through my memory box and I found a card. So when I was on the French exchange, I fell in love with not with my French exchange partner, who I was living with, but one of her friends, a girl, because I wasn't gay back then. I just wasn't out. And I found in my memory box this card that she'd given me, like on the way back. And I remember us like hugging and she was like sobbing and I read it. And like, it was like this beautiful thing. She'd like drawn pictures in it and it was like this beautiful poetry. And I think like by the time I was on the coach, I was like already signing up to the deputy head girl. Like I'd already forgotten and I feel so bad.
I feel bad about young love. It's meant to be fleeting.
It is.
She just had good penmanship and wanted to show it off. I mean, she was using you as much as you were using her. Don't you worry about her. I wonder what she's up to now. This is a common theme on this podcast where I want to find out what has happened to the pen pals. There's going to be the follow-up to this podcast is where I go around France and Germany. I'm going to go and find them all weird, like now 45-year-old Germans who... And I'm going to find your young French woman.
Well, her name was Joanna. We're actually friends on Facebook because she found me on Facebook recently, which is one of the great things about social media and stuff. You can find people. Yeah, so it's like when I watch Long Lost Family and they're like, oh, it looks ages to find them. I'm like, they just did a Facebook search, didn't they? Let's be honest. It's not that difficult.
No, because when I was a kid, we had Surprise, Surprise, and it would have been harder back then when there was no, like, Google. But, like, you know, within minutes I can find somebody. I mean, internet stalking is literally, like, it's the pastime of 99% of office workers.
Totally. And do you know what? I also found some letters from one of my early boyfriends as well. So he did this really cute thing where he was going on holiday for 4 weeks, I think, with his parents, which was obviously when you're in young love, that's like forever, isn't it? So he wrote me a letter for every day that he was away to open, which now looking back, like, seems a bit creepy. But anyway, it was quite cute at the time. And it was nice, but literally by about day five, he'd run out of things to say. So it was just like, they just got shorter and shorter and shorter. And they were just like going, now we'll be at this place. Lots of love. That was it. I was like, you needn't have wasted your time, really.
Just but do young done people one. Write letters now? Like when we went on holiday, even just me and my mates, we would write each other letters when we, like you'd gone to like, I don't know, Dorset for 5 days. And we would write letters before we went about how much we were going to miss each other. Did people just feel things more when there wasn't, like, we weren't, like, bombarded with... And also we couldn't keep in touch with each other via Instagram or whatever. Like, my mate just got to France literally, like, not even, like, 5 hours ago. And she was going this morning. And she's already sent me a picture of her house where she's staying, which she's described as being a sex dungeon.
sounds great. I'm in.
It looks quite sex dungeon-y. It's got like a glass floor and you can see this big dungeon underneath. But she's got 3 kids, little ones. There'll be no sex dungeoning for her. But I suppose it's the same, isn't it? Now, that's what people do now rather than writing letters saying...
They go to sex dungeons.
Yeah.
No, I think you're right, though. I think it's so immediate, isn't it? Social media. And we have it all the time. And you forget, like my brother and his partner and their young baby live in Canada. They've just moved to Canada. And you feel like you're part of their lives because we kind of got like WhatsApp groups and you're seeing stuff on social media. And then you forget, like, oh, you know, like, 3 months have passed and we've not actually really spoken, and you have to kind of make the effort, don't you, to go, let's have a phone call, or, you know, or like sit down and write a letter and kind of take that time.
Even in the pandemic, my brother lives in northern France, and even in the pandemic, I mean, we spoke to each other, we did like a Zoom call every single day with all of us on a big screen, like, which is more than we've spoken to each other since we lived together in 1988. Like, there's this needless amount of conversation. But still, it wasn't like it isn't the same. Like, I didn't see him for 2.5 years, and like that, it's just it isn't the same as actually being with people. But we can definitely con ourselves nowadays that you know we're totally in each other's lives all the time. My husband hates all of that. Like, he hates if I take we go away for the week, and we just went to Edinburgh, and his mates at coffee this morning were telling him all the things he'd done, because my husband's not on any social media, that he was like, how do you know? He's like, oh, Sanjay's Instagram. Like, it's like, he's like, oh,
yeah. Me and my boyfriend the same. I'm a big Instagrammer, and he maybe does like 3 or 4 posts a year, maybe, and they're really special, they're really nice posts, but like really, like, yeah, I'm like literally everything goes on there. And when we meet people and I introduce him, they're like, oh, you're Sean. Like, they just know him already.
I was at Edinburgh, and I was sat down in one of the big sort of bar areas in the show bits at the Pleasance. And this family was sat next to us. And the man came up to me at the bar. I'd gone to the bar, and he said, oh, can I ask, are you Jess Phillips? And I was like, yeah, I am. And he said, oh, I wasn't sure. And you'd left your husband at the table. So we Googled your husband to check it was the right man. And I didn't tell my husband this story when I sat back down with this family and we had a nice chat with them, because I thought my husband will literally go mental at the idea that even there is an image of him on the internet, let alone that somebody is fact checking the man sat next to them, literally on the table with him, fact checking him.
Yeah. That's pretty yeah. Yeah, it is slightly, that is slightly weird.
But you can tell him. I haven't told him because, and he doesn't listen to this. He has nothing to do with anything to do with my life, other than the actual bit of it that's, you know, the real bit. So he won't ever know. You all now know something that he doesn't. So do you have any letters of note that you've kept for years? Obviously, you've got your memory box full of French letters, which obviously is a term for condoms.
French letters. Yeah, I've got the French letters. I've got the letters from my boyfriend. But I was trying to find some like more recent ones and I don't have any. I seem to be the one that always does the letter writing. I don't ever seem to get a response, which I'm starting to get a bit of a complex about because like I think I write some beautiful letters. In fact, we'll go on to it because I've written some letters to people, you know, that have been really important in my life. And I think a letter is like, if you've got something to say that you can't say, a letter is a really, really good way of doing it because you don't need to witness someone's reaction. You can let them have that reaction in private. And, you know, if you're trying to say something difficult, and I always say this, I've got some friends who've said this about coming out as, you know, as gay or bisexual or transgender, like actually you don't know what that reaction is going to be. Even if someone's supportive, there might be disappointment or anger or upset in that first moment. And that can be really hard to deal with. So I think a letter is a great way to kind of do those things. But I've had, honestly, I couldn't find any. I looked through my emails as well. All I've got is, you know, I've just got work emails and like, you know, things from the bills and debt collection agencies and all sorts of stuff. It's boring being an adult, isn't it?
It really is boring. And do you know what? I've never even thought about that. I often talk about how, like, I write letters often that I don't send because I'm trying to get the ideas together about what I would say, even sometimes to myself. It's a bit like diary writing, but like I'll write like an angry letter about leaving my job and then I reflect, I'm not going to leave this job. But I've never even thought about actually one of the most common big things in somebody's life that they probably have written in a letter, certainly in a bygone era, would have been a coming out letter. That would be that, you know, because it's so, I think that what people don't realise about coming out, that is the first thing you've got to get over, I think, is probably talking to your parents about fancying people at all is pretty grim. It's like that, you know, that's a grim thing until you're an adult and you can like have a laugh with them about it. It's like obscenely orcs anyway. Like I want to clam up at the thought of having to do that as like a sort of teenager to talk to my mum about that sort of thing. But like that must be one of the most common things that people have had to do, like that they wouldn't necessarily be a letter writer, but they did that in the form of a letter.
Yeah. My grandparents died relatively recently, so we've been looking through all their stuff and that we've emptied their house and my mum's going through literally everything, and we found so many letters between them, and my mum's one of eight, and my grandma passed away before my granddad, and after she'd passed away me and my granddad were chatting and he basically confessed that my grandma was an infomaniac, which is why they had so many children. Which, you know, again was a bit of a revelation, but it kind of makes sense, I guess, when you've got eight kids. And she did love children as well. She loved having children and a big family. But these letters, I tell you what, they're quite saucy. And you forget, don't you? It's like the past, like, you know, they you know, sort of born in 1930. You think everything's prim and proper, but it really ain't, is it? Like,
not at all. The Victorians were saucy as anything.
I know, it's like this. My grandma's writing letters to my granddad who was away. I think he was either away stationed with the Navy or he was away with work. And it was basically saying, like, I can't wait for you to come back and keep me warm in bed again. You know, it's like, she's like, I hope the kids are out when you get back.
But yeah, I mean, you're right. Just a generation. But in fact, when I was a teenager, it was still like you had to come out like a, it was like, it was a trauma, and there are still lots of, you know, lots of people who that still would be the case. If I think of like young Muslim lads who are gay, you know, it's still like, it's still definitely a thing. But then I think of my own kids and like, there is no coming out anymore. It's not a said thing. Like you wouldn't have to come out. You don't have to come out as straight or gay.
Some of my friends' kids, like, you know, come home from school and they're sort of what, and then they're 7 or 8 and they're talking about pansexual, you know, and they, even my friends who are straight, they're like, what does pansexual mean? You know, so like, you know, we're moving in the right direction. Obviously, it depends on your upbringing. It depends on your family. It depends what, you know, like you said, if there's, you know, even, you know, conservative Christianity, religion in play and all that sort of stuff, it's not always easy, but I think we're moving definitely in the right direction to, you know, better world.
Yeah, we definitely are. I can't imagine my kids sitting me down and saying it to me. It's like a rainbow parade every day when their friends are around here. So I've asked you to think about three people that you would like to send some letters to, which sounds like you've already done, so you're a good egg. You're a prolific letter writer. So the first one is the person who means the world to you. So who would that be?
Well, Jess, there are a number of people I could have chosen here. You know, my beautiful partner, Sean, my best friends, Kira, Adam, Chris, Ross, my mum, who was also wonderful. But I'm not going to choose any of them. I'm going to be totally self-centered and I'm going to choose myself.
Bravo.
Well, you know what, Jess? Like, you know, as Martin Luther King once said, if you can't love yourself, how in the hell are you going to love someone else?
Did he say that?
Well, words to that effect, anyway. So I've chosen my favourite topic of conversation. No, I've even made a show about myself, Jess. So what were you expecting? No, but do you know what? It's been a journey. It has been a journey to get here, so I'm not going to apologise. What's that song? You know, I've been to paradise, but I've never been to me. I was singing that 3 or 4 years ago. Now I've been to me, and I know who I am. So we're gonna delve in deep to the letter that I would write to myself.
So why have you picked yourself then?
Well, I actually did write a letter to my 16-year-old self. When I was 16, around the time when I was coming out as gay. You know, I'd known for a while, but, you know, I was a Section 28 kid. It was repealed 2003, which is the year I came out, 16, the year I left school. And we forget, actually, how homophobic the world was not that long ago. I met someone on Park Bench who was older than me and gay and this exotic gay creature. And we kind of started talking and we hit it off and we had this summer romance. And as a result of that, I contracted HIV for my first time. So there was all this, there was all the kind of unpicking of the shame and the internalized homophobia that you have to go through. And then all of a sudden there was this huge thing, this, you know, this HIV diagnosis, which at the time was not, you know, a death sentence like it was a few years before. Medication was around, but it was certainly not the diagnosis you would get today. It was much heavier. There was still lots of talk about medication side effects because they weren't as advanced as they are now. You know, there was this period of time before you were put on medication, you know, and so basically I just shut down and I didn't tell anyone. I remember coming home to the bedroom I'm sat in now because I actually live with my parents at the minute, and come in, put my key in the door and going, I need to go and tell my mum. And I couldn't. And I came upstairs and I actually lined up some paracetamol that night. You know, I don't think I was ever going to do it. I watched too many episodes of Grange Hill or something. But, you know, there was that thing, there was that drive. And it was like, I can't go on. But what I did at that point is I just cut off. I just shut down. And I just sort of went, oh, well, this thing's happened. I'm going to get on with my life. And I did. I just carried on, but I didn't tell anyone. I told a few people, but I didn't tell my family, which was the main thing. And I kind of lived with this secret bubbling away for about 15 years, just kind of
eating away. You didn't tell your mum for 15 years?
No, and the thing is, we're so close. We're a really close family. But it was the power, and I have to say to people, that's the power of the shame and stigma around HIV. You know, it's the world's most stigmatised illness. And I remember being in school watching in sex ed, and we had this video put on, and it was the only time I saw a gay person on a screen. It's about 14, and it was wildly out of date, and it was this guy who was dying from AIDS, and it was like, the message was, don't be gay, you're going to get AIDS and you're going to die, you know. And when that prophecy came true straight away, it completely shut me down. So, you know, went on 15 years until 2017, and I had, you know, what could be described as a mental breakdown, you know, drugs, alcohol, toxic relationships, sex, all that. So I had this huge breakdown. I was really, really dependent on drugs and alcohol. I was in this awful relationship. And so I decided to turn things around and make a show about it. So I made a solo show called First Time. And I just don't know, it just took me on this journey. It's won awards. It's been, you know, we went to the Edinburgh Fringe. It's been on tour. It's in 100 shows. And, you know, it was the show that led me to get landing a role in It's a Sin on television. You know, I'm just a kid from Stockport. I was like, what is happening? But as part of that, I wrote a letter to my 16-year-old self in about 2012. And it was read at the Manchester Pride candlelit vigil to remember people we've lost to HIV and AIDS. But I was still in a closet at that point, so an actor read it on my behalf. So I'd already written this letter, so that's why I kind of wanted to kind of bring it up now and talk about it.
Well, and when you told your mum, as a mum, I would say that it would hurt me, not because you hadn't told me, the years of wanting to make you feel better. I would feel like lost years that I could have tried to make you feel better, whether it had worked or not. That would be very, very hard.
Yeah, it's exactly what my mum said, actually. And there was also this thing, the longer I left it, the longer I knew it, the more hurt it was going to cause. But it was just so, I tried so many times, it just always got stuck, you know. You know, there's that thing of like, did I do something wrong? What did I do as a parent that meant you couldn't come to me? You know, and I have to, you know, it's been a journey since 2017 when I sent, because I told them through a letter. So that's how I told them before I made the show. And that letter is actually in the show. And everyone at the end of the show gets a copy of that letter to take home. So they go and they can take that letter home and read it privately. So they get to have that kind of private moment. And yeah, you know, it's been a journey to sort of rebuilding that relationship in a sense. And I moved back in with my parents just before the pandemic, and I've lived here for nearly 3 years now. And it's been great because it's meant that we've rebuilt a new adult relationship, which is nice as they're getting older, you know, and that balance changes, doesn't it? Where you're still the child, but you're now becoming more the adult in a sense as you start to care for them. So it was just this crazy thing that totally ate me up for so long.
My brother was a heroin addict and a crack addict for many, many years. And he would say, it's not the drugs that were going to kill him. It was the stigma that would kill him. It was stigma was killing him, because you can't climb out of it. And in fact, in your case, the stigma made you have that sickness as well, which just re-stigmatizes you. And it's just like how other people will see you is the thing that is going to kill you. And like, so we all have an opportunity of the medicine. We, the general public, the society, we have the medicine in us of not stigmatizing people like that. That's like, I think that people should be made to feel more powerful, that you are a medicine. You can be medicine to people by not stigmatizing them for those illnesses that carry such dreadful stigma. And HIV, without doubt, HIV, drug abuse, mental health, they carry terrible stigmas.
Yeah, I said exactly the same thing. I did a speech. Eventually, last year, I spoke at the Manchester Pride vigil, you know, instead, no actors this time, you know, like I speak publicly now, you know, I don't need someone to do it on my behalf, which is amazing. But, you know, I say something similar, you know, I was diagnosed with HIV, but it was the stigma and the shame, not the virus, that nearly led me to breaking point. You know, people don't quite understand the power of that stigma and shame. I didn't understand it. You know, I got to that point where, you know, over probably the course of about 5 or 6 years, my life just kind of fell apart. It was like a car crash, but in slow motion. And I knew it was happening. And I knew I was making these choices, these bad choices. You know, I knew I was mistreating other people because I felt crap about myself. You know, I had such low self-worth that I didn't care. I didn't care if I hurt people. I didn't care, you know, if I hurt myself, or, you know, I'd find myself still awake 2 days after a house party, again, going, how did I get here? You know, just on this kind of cycle. And it was that moment in 2017 where I went, if I don't nip this in the bud, my life is going to take a real real nosedive, you know, and thankfully, you know, the show went well. And I mean, I made the show and it wasn't really about, you know, profile or anything like that. I'd not performed for quite a long time. So I wanted to prove to myself that I still had it, you know, as an actor and as a writer. And, you know, and I just wanted to get this thing off my chest. I almost like had to testify, like I had to just get it out into the universe. And I thought I'd do like 3 or 4 shows. I got a nice little commission in, you know, in Greater Manchester. I'd do a few shows and that would be it. And if it didn't go that well, fine. I'd go down with the ship. I'd go into accounting or whatever, you know, wave me white flag. You're not an actor.
I like the way you went down with the ship, accounting. That is going down with the ship, yeah. Accounting. My son's really good at maths. I'm constantly encouraging him to be an accountant.
There's probably more money than acting, to be honest. You know, and it just really struck a chord. And it was World AIDS Day 2018. And the press kind of got, you know, wind of my story. And BuzzFeed News ran an article which won an award. And then I was on the BBC Breakfast Couch with Charlie and Naga. And, you know, it just snowballed. BBC News article, it was one of the highest articles for about 2 or 3 days on the app. You know, it was shared all around the world. So I was sort of in this, I'd gone from nothing, from not telling anyone to everyone knowing. And it was quite overwhelming. But you know, I had so many messages. I mean, literally thousands. And since then as well, as the show has toured and with It's a Sin, like thousands and thousands of messages of people saying, I wish I could be open about my HIV status. Or, you know, I'm stuck in an abusive relationship and you've inspired me to leave. I'm moving. I'm doing it tomorrow, you know. And it's so humbling to just go, if you speak authentically, it allows others, it frees others to do the same. Like you say, that thing, we've got that medicine within us. It's really powerful.
Yeah, it's a medicine and we're like a gift to the world. You know, that's genuinely the case. But people don't realise it. They don't think, oh, there's nothing I can do about it. And it's like, no, literally there is something you can do about it. Just be nice to somebody who's having a shit time. There you go. You have changed the world immeasurably. If you do that. So how would you sign off this letter? I mean, I presume you have it so you can tell us.
Well, I've written a new ending because I didn't quite like the ending. Well, I've taken a little bit from the original letter. So, Nathaniel, I know you think you've totally messed things up right now and I can't butter it up. The road ahead is going to be a rocky one, but you are more resilient than you might think. In the darkest times, remember this. You are enough. Yours sincerely, Nathaniel. P.S., cut your hair. It's an absolute affront to good taste. I like that.
Well, that is very, very moving. And, you know, I hope that people who listen to this, you know, it always makes people feel better when people talk about their authentically about their experiences, especially of stigma, because I wish that we could say that with HIV is definitely... It's waning, although it still would be terrifying. If one of my sons came and said to me that they were HIV positive, I would still feel very alarmed. But I grew up in the, you know, the big bloody, the stone dropping
the
on the floor.
Tombstone.
Yeah, the tombstone. Like, that is, like, constantly my... But, like, there's lots of things, like abortion is still really stigmatised and you're not meant to talk about it. And there's all sorts of things that are completely regular health issues that are still really, really stigmatised. So it is really important that people keep speaking about those things. So the second letter is to somebody... you know, it would be such a baller move if you wrote every letter to yourself.
Wow, it's funny you should say that. No, I haven't, I promise.
So the second letter is to somebody who is no longer with us. So who would that be to?
Well, this one is to, I've already mentioned before, is to my granddad, who passed away in 2020 at the start of the pandemic. And it was in that funny stage just before we kind of knew it was coming. And sort of hospitals were starting to have restrictions, but we weren't quite in lockdown yet. And we could see it happening in Italy. And, you know, it was like, it's going to happen here, isn't it? And my granddad had been, you know, had been sick for a while and been in and out of hospital. And an ambulance was called because he was unwell. And it breaks my heart. My mum was there and he said to her, Christine, don't let me go in because I won't come back. Because he knew. So he went into hospital and... he had an operation and he was fine and he was recovering. But then my mum couldn't visit because she was asthmatic and they were saying, no, you can't come because of COVID. And then we went into, you know, full lockdown and it was no visitors. And he died, you know, about a week after that. So it was really horrible, you know, and not being able to go to funerals and just that thought of someone. I mean, you know, the nurses said that someone was with him, but, you know, no one that he knew or loved was there. So really hard. But he was an incredible man. And I don't want to dwell too much on, you know, the sadness of his death, because he is literally like, he is the Don. He's the Don of our family. And I've got a huge family. I've got 17 cousins. My grandma and granddad, they had 8 kids. You know, there's a lot of like...
I like that the next rung down didn't all have 8 kids, because you'd be one of like 64.
Can you imagine our carbon footprint?
Yeah, it'd be dreadful.
I'm gay. I'm not having any. So I'm doing my bit for the planet.
You are. Your nan definitely took your quota.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, yeah, but, you know, he was an amazing man. He was. And he really like grabbed life, like, to the full, and lived life to the fullest. He smoked like a chimney. Well, he actually gave up later in life, but I knew I used to catch him round the back. Dave was going, don't tell your grandma smoking his woodbine. You know, he drank loads of wine, he ate loads of cheese. He was just like, if you're enjoying life, you'll live a good life. And there was always laughter wherever he was. He never really, I don't think he ever really grew up. I always see him in my head as a sort of naughty schoolboy. And he was a really naughty schoolboy as well. He was just great. And I mean, one of my favourite stories of my granddad. So when he was in the Navy, he was stationed in the Navy in the late 40s, early 50s. And he was away, and him and my grandma were dating. And so they'd written letters and arranged she was going to come. I think it was Southampton where he was stationed. So she was going to come and meet him for the day. They were going to go to the cinema, you know, watch some films, have a nice day. And she'd come back. Well, she arrives at the agreed, you know, point to meet. Obviously, no phones or anything to text or go, I'm running late. She arrives at the town clock or whatever. And this random man walks up to her and says, are you Sylvia? And she's like, yeah. And I'm your date for today. And she's like, what do you mean? She's like, Raymond was caught dealing his tobacco, which is illegal in the Navy, and is in naval jail in Janku. So he sent me instead.
This is the man for me. Criminal.
So she went, and she did. She went to the cinema. She was like, I've travelled all the way, so I'm still going to go. And I'm still going to go. I'm not going to turn away, am I? She's like, I've paid the train fare. So a different era. Anyway, so just all these incredible stories, you know, of him. And he was, yeah, he was just this wonderful, wonderful man.
It's quite noble to send somebody else. I think that is like, that's a risk. That is quite
trusting, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that could have ended very different.
A man and all that, but
could have ended very differently. That story, I might not be here. He was one of those men. He was a Christian, and he was led by his faith. And you know, he was fascinated by the world, and he really taught me the importance of seeking knowledge and learning, not to earn money or get better, you know, just to better yourself, just be curious, just to learn. You know, he was right up until, you know, he was 89, you know, he was still learning new things and had this thirst for knowledge and wanted to learn about things. And I remember we were, my eldest brother's wedding, and it was around the time the gay marriage debate was raging, you know, in the press and stuff. And I think previously my granddad, only because of the era he'd grown up in, you know, was sort of, and what he'd been told through his faith was that actually maybe it was for, you know, marriage was a man and a woman. But I remember he pulled me over just before the service, and he'd been praying, and he just said, look, I've been thinking a lot on this and praying a lot on this, and who am I to say that you, my grandson, can't have what me and your grandma have had, like the absolute joy and blessings that we've had through marriage. And he's like, it's totally changed my perception. And I think it was a really beautiful moment for me, but also to just think that we don't have to be stuck in our ways. We can change. And you don't, you know, we have this perception that if you're old, you have to be cantankerous and kind of, and you don't. And hateful, yeah. And he was not a bone of hate in his body.
What I think fascinates me, and one thing that I absolutely hate about the way that we talk about certain generations and also certain classes of people, not just certain classes, old working class people, is that my experience of that generation of, and my grandparents were like born in places that were cleared in the slums. The idea that they weren't always striving to be clever, not for money. My grandparents were fascinated by different cultures and reading different sorts of, they only ever went to a charabanc to Western, that's like as far as they ever got, but they were not unworldly. They were not unworldly at all, yet the way that old people, certainly since Brexit, old people and working class people have been represented is just like, oh my God, you've totally misconstrued. And when they're written about, working class people are written about in anything other than like in modern times, like if we look back, you know, we're quite romantic about working class people from the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. But nowadays, people are just thick and...
Yeah. Yeah,
I hate that.
Thick and work shy, isn't it? That's the narrative. Yeah, and it's not true. It's not true at all. And you know, my grandparents. We always make excuses as well when we talk about like racism and or we've been having all these really important conversations. You know, and again, Black Lives Matter has kind of re-energized that, rightly so. And you know, we have this thing like, well, it's just a different era, different time. And it's like, no, racism's racism. My grandma and granddad did not have a racist bone in their body, so we are making excuses for people when we say that. There are people who out there are racist, and we have to call it out. But this idea that that generation, or like you say, like working class people, are grouped together to be all the same, like that.
My nan was a dinner lady and a single mom, and she protested when they wouldn't let Black South Africans play, when the teams came over. She literally, as a little old lady, went and like chained themselves to the railings of the sports stadiums. Like, she was sold into servitude. That's how poor she was. Like, it's not. And my other granny was a racist. It wasn't just because she was from a certain era. She didn't like foreigners.
Yeah, yeah. And it depends. I think
she was a nice woman to me. And I don't think that she didn't. And she was an incredibly generous woman and would do almost anything for anyone. But she definitely was a bit racist. Like, that's okay, to say that. Like, that's the reality. One of my nans wasn't. One of my nans was, because some people are and some people aren't.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah, absolutely, yeah. But I really adored my granddad and my grandma, and it's been a real adjustment to kind of them not being here anymore. And also, my grandma died before the pandemic, and had dementia. I remember actually, they used to come round here to my mum and dad's every Sunday for dinner, and getting more and more frail, trying to help them out the car. My grandma with dementia, struggling to move and walk, and I remember we were coming in, I was helping them both in, and we were slightly behind, and my granddad said to me, as I was helping him up the curb, he said, "I'm only waiting for her to go, lad." And I just thought, that's love, isn't it? Like, they,
old people definitely do that. There's got to be some science, there will be somebody who's written about it, but like, my nan died the day that my mum had a job interview, and she waited until my mum got to the hospital to tell her that she'd got the job, and she literally died 5 minutes later. And it's like, that is like a thing.
Holding them. Yeah, I think so.
It's very easy now that we're not in lockdown and COVID is apparently gone, although it's not, to forget what that was like. Because even as you were talking about when we were watching it in Italy and it felt otherworldly, like it was that made me remember that period that I'd forgotten. It's just like one day we were in lockdown, but there was this terrifying period. I think that maybe we're all just so tired at the moment, but in the next decade, the reflection on that time is going to be epic. Like, that is, it feels like something from a film. It's just, it was so difficult and so weird. And to lose somebody during that, like, is just, it seems unimaginable. I remember people for the first time ever checked their privilege like without recognizing that that's what they were doing, because that's like, you know, chicks of privilege. Like people like me were like, well, we've been very lucky because we haven't known anyone who's died in this period. Like, you know, even just something like, we're very lucky because we've got a garden. But that idea that we were dodging a bullet and other people were dying was very real.
Yeah, yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think it's quite crazy, crazy time. But I think it really shows the resilience, like how we're so, we, you know, our, the structure of our society and how we, everything is run is, we know, is so interconnected. It's so finely balanced, isn't it? You pull one thing out and everything else starts to tumble. And that's quite terrifying. But actually, when you're confronted with it, you see quite how resilient humans are. And you go, okay, that's why there's, you know, what is it, 7 billion of us, you know, like that's why we've made it this far. We're a pack and we do have real resilience. And yeah, you know, like there's lots of awful things about humankind, but there's lots of amazing things as well. And I think that period of time definitely showed that.
I call that socialism.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's what my grandparents taught me.
And my granddad was definitely a socialist. So
so how would you sign off a letter to your lovely granddad?
Granddad, as well as teaching me important skills like baking and how to read a map, you taught me so much about what is important in this life. Family, good food, fun and laughter. You were the absolute light, the dawn of our family, and not a day goes by we don't miss you. Yours sincerely, Nathaniel.
We'll be back for the final letter after this short break. But first, let me tell you about something exciting coming up. This autumn, I'm hosting my first ever live audience recording of Yours Sincerely. I'll be closing off the final night of the Birmingham Literature Festival by interviewing the author, broadcaster and founder of Beauty Banks, Sally Hughes. Come and join us on October the 9th at the Birmingham Rep for a great conversation and the chance to ask your own questions. To find out more and get tickets, visit the Birmingham Literature Festival website, which will be linked in the description.
Ever yearned for the perfect pub to reveal itself from some unexpected alley? Well, The Moon Underwater is the podcast for you. Join me, John Robbins, and the lovely Robin Allender.
Hi.
As we help a special guest create their dream pub. From the drinks behind the bar to the music on the jukebox, The Moon Underwater is whatever you want it to be. So, if you would like to join us in Desire's beating heart, search The Moon Underwater. Or maybe The Moon Underwater will search for you.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
So the final letter I asked you to think about was somebody who doesn't know the effect they've had on your life. So who would that be?
So this is a slightly left field one. Not me. this is for my first boyfriend, Nick, who we don't speak anymore. Well, occasionally we do, but he moved to Australia. And it's slightly odd because he'd left me for someone else. He left me for one of our friends who he married. So it was quite a dramatic end to our relationship. We met around the time when I was diagnosed with HIV. So we met at college and, you know, there was this really kind of, you know, exciting young love. It, despite the fact that I'd had this kind of fling with this older guy, this was really the first. This was where I was with someone my own age and discovering, you know, all that heart fluttering feeling. And I think for both of us, kind of going, oh my God, we've lived feeling like aliens almost, you do as a gay person growing up, and then all of a sudden that all floods out when you realize that there are other people like you and that you can express that. So we were doing a production of Road, which is one of my favorite plays, and you know, we were kind of like snogging behind like the scenery, you know, no one knew, and it was all very exciting. So we were together for 8 years until we were 24, and then he pulled this shitty move on me. You know, it was very dramatic. You know, there was like clothes being thrown out of the front window and all that kind of stuff. Because it was the end of the, you know, you've 8 years together at that age, you think.
That's a very northern of you, like a sort of northern sitcom.
Yeah, absolutely. I look back and laugh now, but it was, you know, it felt quite real at the time and quite serious. But you regulate your emotions a bit better as you get older, I think.
I think that being with somebody for 8 years who then goes up with your mate.
Yeah.
I'm saying it's fair.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
About that.
And, you know, and I think we had quite a strong bond because of, I remember, so the day I came home from the hospital with the diagnosis, and we were messaging one another. The messages were expensive back then. You have to use all your characters.
Oh, God, yeah.
10p like, a message,
it was,
right?
Was, yeah, really. I remember when it was like 40p for a text message. Nobody gets messaged.
No. So, and I, you know, and I said, you know, I've had some really bad news and I'm really upset. And he actually ran all the way from his parents' house. It was before he got a car, and it was, that's not that close. It's quite a way. Like, it's not just down the road. And he came all the way. And I remember standing in my parents' attic and just crying and saying to him, you know, look, this has happened. And actually I genuinely meant this as well. I said, I don't blame you if you walk away, because it's just so heavy, and actually you're just discovering, you know, your sexuality. You've not even come out to your parents yet. It was like, it was a lot for kids to take on. And I, you know, which I think it's quite mature, actually, thing to say, just like, you
it's
know,
it's incredibly mature. I'm the mother of a 17-year-old, and you put them to shame. So on being that mature.
But he just said, no, we stick it out together. Like, and that was that. I think that cemented quite a strong bond, but potentially maybe not the healthiest bond over time, because I think maybe there was this sense of like having to stay together to honour that bond. And I think maybe he felt that as we kind of got further on in the relationship, that he had to kind of honour that. And, you know, it's quite rare for people to meet at 16 and stay together for life. I mean, it's very rare for gay men. Like, come on. So, you know, but the reason why I wanted to write this letter or talk about this was because, despite that, you know, and I do joke, you know, I always, you know, I'm on stage and, you know, I crack jokes with people and, you know, I say, you know, even my cat left me, like all my other boyfriends, you know, but actually, you know, we spent 8 amazing years together, and there was so much. And sometimes we forget that. When something is broken down, or when we've had a, you know, the end of a relationship's been messy, we forget about all the good stuff. And I think it's really important to remind yourself that it wasn't 8 years of crap. Like, it was eight incredible years. And, you know, we did everything. You know, we were young and stupid, and we cheated on one another, and we, you know, we experimented, we played around, we streaked naked, we traveled the world together. You know, we went to India and Thailand, and we backpacked around Australia, you know, and in this van, this clapped out van driving through the outback. We nearly died in a flash flood and a thunderstorm. You know, we just had all these incredible, like, life-forming experiences, these, like, real kind of moments. But I think through all that, there was always this fear and anxiety, because this was pre... So now people on medication, we know, on HIV medication, if they're virally suppressed, cannot pass the virus on. So now I can have unprotected sex with my partner, Sean. But back then we didn't know that information. And also I wasn't on medication for the first 5 years. So there was always this fear and anxiety around sex. And I think that was quite a lot to carry. And then, you know, he supported me through starting medication, which I was really sick when I started medication. I had really bad side effects. And it was a lot to carry. And I don't always think that I was the best person to be around. you know, and looking back, I think I'm much more in tune now because I've had a lot of therapy on how the impacts, the emotional impact HIV has had on me, the psychological impact, you know, generalized anxiety disorder. I've got post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of it. And, you know,
you were 16 years old. I don't think that you can. Yeah. I mean, all 16-year-olds think that they, like I did, that they,
you know, everything.
You know everything. Like, now, as the mother of a 17-year-old, the thought of my son going through something like that and also having his sexual liberation to be so, and this is not an uncommon experience actually for young women, to be basically tainted with fear. It's easy to talk about in hindsight, but if you actually step into it as of now, it is, it's a huge thing.
It is. And I think the reason why I wanted to write this and say thank you, you know, was that even in those dark times and those times where I probably was difficult to be around and support and love, you know, he just used to make me laugh. Like, we used to absolutely cry laughing. The most stupid thing, we used to dance. We had this thing about high-waisted jeans. So if we were feeling down, we put like women's jeans on really, really high. So you have that really lovely like Asda Price wedgie and just put like 80s music on and dance. And it doesn't even sound funny, but we just used to fall about laughing. And, you know, and he just had this wit and this humour that could really bring me out of that place. And like I say, you know, inspiring me to go travelling. When I got diagnosed, there are so many countries you're not supposed to pass through as HIV. And I just went, oh, well, that's it. And those dreams are not happening. But he just told me, fuck it, just do it. He was like, we can do it. And we did, and we made it work, and we hid medication, and we just, you know, I've just been through some countries illegally. But without him, I wouldn't have done it. And I needed that person there beside me to, you know, to just kind of make me take the leap, you know, because sometimes I am, before the HIV diagnosis, I think I've always been a bit of a, you know, a worrier, a what if. Like, I've been wanting to get a tattoo for 30 years. I'm getting one in a few weeks' time. That's how long it's taken me to take that decision. So to have someone like, you know, like Nick for 8 years, who was there, you know, and, you know, it wasn't perfect. He was a dick sometimes. I was a dick sometimes, as all relationships.
Who isn't a dick sometimes? I mean, in any one given dad.
Absolutely. And it ended in the way it did. And maybe, I think, now with, you know, that was 24. That's 11 years ago now. And I think now I'm at that stage where I can look back more nostalgically and go, actually, I really appreciate those times, and I want to say thank you for that, I think.
Yeah. Ah, well, that's nice. When I was 16, I started going out with my first boyfriend, and I went out with him till I was 20, 21. And when I broke up with him, I went away with one of my mates to Thailand, and I just felt like I'd wasted 6 years of my life. And like, and she made me every single day when we got up, she made me talk about a happy memory of that 6 years, because it wasn't a waste and it wasn't all shit. It was like 6 years of your life, and it mattered. And don't like just remember the shit bit at the end. But yeah, I think all 16-year-old relationships from, you know, post the 1960s, because my mom married my dad when she was 16. It's just a recipe for disaster, frankly. It's like cheating on each other. I mean, maybe kids these days aren't, but like, it was just like, we all just cheated on each other all the time, and then had the audacity to be upset about it, like when you'd also done it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. God, I moved away for uni and he stayed in Manchester. You know, so he was always traveling. Again, that's another thing. Like, he'd travel over. I was in near Leeds. I was at a place called Bretton Hall, which is in near Yorkshire Sculpture Park. It's a beautiful like campus in the middle of the countryside with a 17th century mansion. But you can imagine a load of arts kids in the middle of nowhere. Literally, you needed a car to get somewhere. Like, once the sun went down, that was it. You were like locked down. Yeah, we had our own bar on campus, you know, with the stuff that we got up to, you know, and we had a great time. I don't regret it. But, you know, all that stuff happened, and he was there through it. You know, he was traveling over, and he was, yeah, by my side. And we did write letters to one another, now thinking about it, like more than the ones I was joking about before, you know, the ones from when he went on holiday and wrote me one every day. But, you know, I think we were, you know, we were young and in love, which is a beautiful feeling, and not like when you get a bit older and you're cynical about it all.
Yeah. I'm just, you know, I mean, I'm happy in the silence now. I've been with my husband for 20 years and it's just like, I see couples chatting and I think, haven't you been over this?
Yeah.
Haven't you discussed this already? Like, you must have covered this. Like,
Yeah. I think if you can be comfortable in the presence of your partner, that's a real good sign. And my new partner, Sean, you know, we've both lived a life. Like, you know, as you can hear about mine, and there's a lot more that I've not talked about. And, you know, we've done the work now, and actually, you know, it's quite nice to be with someone who you just don't need to talk all the time. And you're comfortable, because sometimes I think when you're less comfortable with people is when you try and talk.
So how would you sign off the letter to Nick?
Okay, so Nick, even though you were a bastard and eventually left me for someone else, time is a great healer. And I want to say how honoured I am for the 8 years of this life you walked with me. Thank you for picking me up when I couldn't go on, encouraging me to grab life by the horns, showing me it really is for living to the absolute fullest, and for all the uncontrollable, side-splitting laughter we had whilst dancing with wedgies. Yours sincerely, Nathaniel.
I mean, I really feel you've summed up an 8-year relationship there, in that sometimes it is like one thing. On my deathbed, I will laugh about the fact, and it's not even funny. It's not funny. But when I had my first baby, I went into the hospital and they'd written, my husband, who's called Tom, they had written his name on our notes as if his name was Ron Phillips. And it was made me laugh. Because we were like 24, and he was like 24, and I was like, that, they think you called Ron. Like, that makes me laugh, and will make me laugh for the rest of my life. And if I'm down, he can just say, it's all right, love, Ron Phillips is here. And
that is definitely real love. You got that little joke. That's brilliant.
Well, Nathaniel, it has been an absolute pleasure talking to you. It's like therapy talking to you. So thank you so much for coming on, and thank you for being the cusp point of the people who still write letters.
I thought you were going to say thank you for being someone who writes letters to themselves.
I mean, also, that is brilliant. I like, it's original. Nobody else has. Everybody else has wanted to. Nobody has been so bold.
Yeah, exactly. I'm unique. But thank you anyway. It's been a joy.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Yours Sincerely with Jess Phillips. If you want to hear more conversations just like this, make sure you follow Yours Sincerely with Jess Phillips on the podcast provider of your choice. And why not write a letter to your friends, telling them all about this podcast? You could also follow us on social media. We're at Jess Phillips Pod. Goodbye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.